Liberty, by John Stuart Mill, first published in 1859. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapter 3. Individuality, One of the Elements of Well-Being. I have presented the reasons that make it imperative for human beings to be free to form opinions and express them openly, and the pernicious consequences to man's intellectual nature, and through that to his moral nature, if this freedom is not either granted or claimed, despite being prohibited. Now let us see whether those same reasons don't require that men should be free to act on their opinions, to carry them out in their lives, without physical or moral hindrance from their fellow men, so long as they are acting at their own risk and peril. This last proviso is, of course, indispensable. No one claims that actions should be as free as opinions. On the contrary, even opinions lose their immunity in circumstances where merely expressing them is a positive incitement to some harmful act. The opinion that corn dealers are starvers of the poor ought to be allowed to pass freely when it is simply presented to the world in print. But someone can justly be punished for announcing it orally, or passing it out on a placard to an excited mob gathered before a corn dealer's house. Acts of any kind that harm others without justifiable cause may be, and in the more important cases absolutely must be, brought under control, either by adverse opinion or, when necessary, by active interference. The liberty of the individual must be limited by this. He must not adversely affect other people. But if he refrains from interfering with others, in things that are their own concern, and merely acts according to his own inclination and judgment, in things that concern himself, he should be freely allowed to put his opinions into practice at his own cost. And the reasons for this are the very ones that show that opinion should be free. Mankind are not infallible. Their truths are mostly only half-truths. Uniformity of opinion is not desirable unless it results from the fullest and freest comparison of opposite opinions. Diversity of opinion is a good thing, not a bad one, until mankind greatly improve their ability to recognize all sides of the truth. These principles apply as much to men's conduct as to their opinions. While mankind are imperfect, it is useful for there to be not only different opinions, but also different experiments in living, for different kinds of personal character to be given free scope, as long as they don't injure others, and for different ways of life to be tried out in practice when anyone wants to try them. It is desirable, in short, that in matters that don't primarily concern others, individuality should assert itself. When a person's conduct is ruled not by his character, but by the traditions or customs of others, one of the principal ingredients of human happiness, and the chief ingredient of individual and social progress, is lacking. The greatest difficulty one meets in maintaining this principle doesn't come from people's views about the means to an acknowledged end, but from their indifference to the end in question. If it were generally felt that the free development of individuality is a leading essential of well-being, that it isn't merely something that comes along with civilization, instruction, education, and culture, but is itself a necessary part and precondition of all those things, there would be no danger of liberties being undervalued, and no great difficulty about settling the boundaries between it and social control. The trouble is that in the thinking of most people, individual spontaneity is hardly recognized as having any intrinsic value, or as deserving any respect on its own account. The majority are satisfied with the ways of mankind as they are now, and can't understand why those ways shouldn't be good enough for everybody. As for moral and social reformers, who by definition are not satisfied with the ways of mankind as they are now, the majority of them don't have spontaneity as part of their ideal. Rather, they look on it with resentment, as a troublesome obstruction to the general acceptance of what these reformers think would be best for mankind. Wilhelm von Humboldt, so eminent both for his learning and as a politician, based his book The Limits of State Action on the thesis that the end of man, what is prescribed by the eternal dictates of reason, and not suggested by vague passing desires, is the highest and most harmonious development of his powers to a complete and consistent whole. That therefore, what every human being must ceaselessly direct his efforts towards, especially those who design to influence their fellow men, is the individuality of power and development. And that for this, two things are needed: freedom and a variety of situations, from the combination of which arise individual vigour and great diversity, which combine themselves in originality. Few people outside Germany even understood what he meant. And yet, although most people are unaccustomed to a doctrine like that of von Humboldt, and surprised to find anyone attaching so high a value to individuality, one has to think that the issue, the difference between the majority view and von Humboldt's, can only be one of degree. Looking at it from one side, no one's idea of excellence in conduct is that people should do absolutely nothing but copy one another. No one would assert that how people live and handle their affairs ought to bear no mark whatsoever of their own judgment or of their own individual character. On the other hand, it would be absurd to value individuality so absolutely as to claim that people ought to live as if they had nothing to learn from the past, as if experience so far had done nothing towards showing that one way of life or course of conduct is preferable to another. Nobody denies that people should be taught and trained in youth, so that they can know what has been learned from human experience and can benefit from it. But when a human being has arrived at the maturity of his faculties, it is his privilege, and indeed his proper role, to use and interpret experience in his own way. It is for him to find out what part of recorded experience is properly applicable to his own circumstances and character. The traditions and customs of other people provide some evidence of what their experience has taught them, evidence that has some weight and therefore should be treated by him with respect. But there are three reasons for not letting it settle how he should live his life. In the first place, those people's experience may be too narrow, or they may not have interpreted it correctly. Secondly, their interpretation of their experience may be correct, but unsuitable to him. Customs are made for customary circumstances and character, and his circumstances or character may be uncustomary. Thirdly, even when the customs are good in themselves and are suitable to him, still he ought not to conform to custom merely as custom, because that will not develop in him any of the qualities that are the distinctive endowment of a human being. The human faculties of perception, judgment, discriminative feeling, mental activity, and even moral preference are exercised only in making choices. He who does something because it is the custom doesn't make a choice. He gains no practice either in seeing what is best or in wanting it. Like our muscular powers, our mental and moral powers are improved only by use. You don't bring your faculties into play by doing something merely because others do it, any more than by believing something only because others believe it. If the reasons for an opinion are not conclusive in your way of thinking, your reason can't be strengthened by your adopting the opinion, and is likely instead to be weakened. And if the reasons for acting in a certain way are not in harmony with your feelings and character, acting in that way contributes to making your feelings and character inert and slack, rather than active and energetic. He who lets the world, or his own portion of it, choose his plan of life for him, doesn't need any faculty other than the ape-like ability to imitate. He who chooses his plan for himself employs all his faculties. He must use observation to see, reasoning and judgment to foresee, activity to gather materials for decision, discrimination to decide, and, when he has decided, firmness and self-control to keep to his deliberate decision. and how much he requires and uses these abilities depends directly on how much of his conduct is determined according to his own judgment and feelings. He might be guided in some good path, and kept out of harm's way, without any of these things. But in that case, what will be his comparative worth as a human being? It really does matter, not only what men do, but also what sort of men they are that do it. Among the works of man that we are rightly employed in perfecting and beautifying, surely the most important is man himself. Supposing it were possible to get machinery, automatons in human form, to build houses, grow corn, fight battles, try cases, and even build churches and say prayers, it would be a considerable loss to accept automatons in exchange for men and women, even the ones who now inhabit the more civilized parts of the world, who are poor specimens of what nature can and will produce. Human nature is not a machine to be built on the basis of a blueprint and set to do exactly the work prescribed for it. Rather, it is a tree that needs to grow and develop on all sides, driven by the inner forces that make it a living thing. It will probably be conceded that people should exercise their understandings, and that an intelligent following of custom, or even occasionally an intelligent deviation from custom, is better than following custom blindly and mechanically. To a certain extent, it is admitted that our understanding should be our own. But there isn't the same willingness to admit that our desires and impulses should likewise be our own, or to admit that it can be safe and satisfactory for us to have strong impulses of our own. Yet desires and impulses are as much a part of a perfect human being as beliefs and restraints. Strong impulses are perilous only when not properly balanced, i.e., when one set of aims and inclinations is strengthened, while others that ought to coexist with them remain weak and inactive. Men act badly, not because their desires are strong, but because their consciences are weak. To say that one person's desires and feelings are stronger and more various than those of someone else is merely to say that he has more of the raw material of human nature, and is therefore capable, perhaps, of more evil, but certainly of more good. Strong impulses are but another name for energy. Energy can be turned to bad uses, but more good can always come from an energetic nature than from a slack and impassive one. Those who have most natural feeling are always those whose cultivated feelings, the ones developed through education, experience, and thought, can also be made the strongest. The strong susceptibilities that make personal impulses vivid and powerful are also the source of the most passionate love of virtue and the sternest self-control. Society does its duty and protects its interests by developing these susceptibilities, not by rejecting the stuff of which heroes are made, because it doesn't know how to make them. A person whose desires and impulses are his own, expressing his own nature as it has been developed and modified by his own culture, is said to have a character. One whose desires and impulses are not his own doesn't have a character, any more than a steam engine does. If the impulses are not only his, but are strong, and are under the control of a strong will, then he has an energetic character. If you think that individuality of desires and impulses shouldn't be encouraged, you must maintain that society doesn't need strong natures, and that a high average level of energy is not desirable. In some early states of society, these forces of high-level individual energy were too far ahead of society's power at that time to discipline and control them. There was a time when the element of spontaneity and individuality was excessive, and social forces had a hard struggle with it. The difficulty then was to induce men with strong bodies or minds to obey any rules requiring them to control their impulses. To overcome this difficulty, law and discipline behaved like the popes in their struggle against the emperors. They asserted a power over the whole man, claiming to control all his life in order to control his character. But society now has the upper hand over individuality, and the danger that threatens human nature is not too much in the way of personal impulses and preferences, but too little. Things have changed vastly since the time when the passions of those who were strong, through rank, position, or personal qualities, were in a state of habitual rebellion against laws and ordinances, and had to be strictly held down, so that people within their reach might enjoy a little security. In our times, from the highest class of society down to the lowest, everyone lives as though under the eye of a hostile and dreaded censorship. People don't ask themselves, "What do I prefer?" or "What would suit my character and disposition?" or "What would allow the best and highest in me to be exercised, enabling it to grow and thrive?" They ask themselves, "What is suitable to my position?" "What is usually done by people in my position and economic level?" or, worse still, "What is usually done by people whose position and circumstances are superior to mine?" I don't mean that they choose what is customary over what suits their own inclination. It doesn't occur to them to have any inclination, except to do what is customary. Thus the mind itself is bent under the yoke, even in what people do for pleasure. Conformity is the first thing they think of. They like in crowds. They exercise choice only among things that are commonly done. They shun peculiarity of taste and eccentricity of conduct as much as they shun crimes. Eventually, by not following their own nature, they come to have no nature to follow. Their human capacities are withered and starved. They become incapable of any strong wishes or natural pleasures, and are generally without opinions or feelings that are homegrown and properly theirs. Now is this the desirable condition of human nature? It is so on the Calvinistic theory. According to it, the one great offence of man is self-will. Obedience contains all the good humanity is capable of. You have no choice. You must do this and nothing else. Whatever isn't a duty is a sin. Human nature is radically corrupt, so there is no redemption for anyone until human nature is killed within him. To someone who holds this theory of life, there is nothing wrong with crushing out any of the human faculties, capacities, and susceptibilities. The only capacity necessary for a man is to surrender himself to the will of God. And if he uses any of his faculties for anything else, he would be better without them. That is the theory of Calvinism, and many who don't consider themselves Calvinists also accept it in a milder form, according to which it is God's will that mankind should gratify some of their inclinations, not of course in the way they themselves prefer, but in the way of obedience, i.e., in a way prescribed to them by authority, and therefore inevitably the same for all. The crucial point about this milder form of Calvinism is that it still doesn't allow for individuality of character. In some such insidious form as this, there is at present a strong tendency to adopt this narrow theory of life, and the pinched and hidebound type of human character that it favours. No doubt many people sincerely think that human beings thus cramped and dwarfed are as their makers designed them to be. Just as many have thought that trees with all their lower branches removed or clipped into figures of animals are much finer than in their natural state. But if religion includes the belief that man was made by a good being, it is more consistent with that faith to believe that this being gave humans all their faculties to be developed, not rooted out and incinerated, and that he takes delight in every advance his creatures make towards the ideal of which they are capable, every increase in their ability to understand, to act, or to enjoy. According to the Calvinistic conception of humanity, we had our nature bestowed on us purely in order to have it stamped out. There is a different ideal of human excellence from that. Pagan self-assertion is one of the elements of human worth, as well as Christian self-denial. There is a Greek ideal of self-development, which the Platonic and Christian ideal of self-government blends with, but does not supersede. The way to make human beings become noble and beautiful to see and think about is not by grinding all that is individual in them down into uniformity, but rather by cultivating it and enabling it to grow within the limits imposed by the rights and interests of others. and that is also the way to make human life become rich, diversified, and energetic, providing more abundant nourishment for high thoughts and elevated feelings, and strengthening the tie that binds every individual to the human race, by making the race infinitely better worth belonging to. The more each person develops his individuality, the more valuable he becomes to himself, and thus the more capable of being valuable to others. There is a greater fullness of life about his own existence, and when there is more life in the units, there is more in the mass composed of them. The mass has to be compressed enough to prevent the stronger specimens of human nature from encroaching on the rights of others, but this is amply compensated for, even from the point of view of human development. When an individual is prevented from gratifying his inclinations at the expense of others, the means of development that this deprives him of was chiefly obtained at the expense of the development of other people, so that this lessening of his development may produce an overall gain in human development. And even he suffers no real net loss, because what is suppressed in him, in the interests of others, is balanced by the better development of the social part of his nature, which is made possible by the restraint put on the selfish part. Being held to rigid rules of justice for the sake of others develops the feelings and capacities that aim at the good of others. But being restrained in things that don't affect their good, restrained merely by their displeasure, develops nothing valuable except such force of character as may develop in resisting the restraint. If the restraint is accepted, it dulls and blunts the person's whole nature. To give any fair play to the nature of each person, it is essential to allow different people to lead different lives. Historical periods have been noteworthy to posterity in proportion to how widely they have allowed this. Even despotism doesn't produce its worst effects so long as individuality exists under it. And whatever crushes individuality is despotism, whatever name it is given, and whether it claims to be enforcing the will of God or the commands of men. Having said that, individuality is the same thing as development, and that the cultivation of individuality is the only thing that does or can produce well-developed human beings, I might here close the argument. For what more or better can be said of any condition of human affairs than that it brings human beings themselves nearer to the best they can be? Or what worse can be said of any obstruction to good than that it prevents this? Doubtless, however, these considerations won't be enough to convince those who most need convincing. So I need also to show that these developed human beings are of some use to undeveloped ones, to point out to those who don't want liberty, and wouldn't make use of it if they had it, that they may be rewarded in some way they can understand for freely allowing other people to make use of liberty. In the first place, then, I suggest that those who don't want liberty might possibly learn something from the exercise of liberty by those who do want it. No one will deny that originality is a valuable element in human affairs. There is always need for people not only to discover new truths and point out when a former truth is no longer true, but also to start new practices, and to set the example of more enlightened conduct, and of better taste and sense in human life. Someone who denied this would have to think that the world has already attained perfection in all its ways and practices. Admittedly, not everyone is able to provide this benefit. There are a few people, a small fragment of mankind, whose experiments in living, if adopted by others, would be an improvement on established practice. But these few are the salt of the earth. Without them, human life would become a stagnant pool. I'm talking not only about the ones who introduce good things that didn't exist before, but also about those who keep alive the good things that already exist. If there were nothing new to be done, would human intellect cease to be necessary? Would it be a reason why those who do the old things should forget why they are done, and do them like cattle rather than like human beings? Even the best beliefs and practices are all too likely to degenerate into something mechanical. And unless there were a succession of people whose ever-recurring originality prevents the grounds of those beliefs and practices from becoming merely traditional, such dead matter wouldn't survive the smallest jolt from anything really alive, and there would be no reason why civilization shouldn't die out, as did the Byzantine Empire. It's true that persons of genius are, and probably always will be, a small minority, but in order to have them, we must preserve the soil in which they grow. Genius, meaning high intelligence combined with creative imagination, can breathe freely only in an atmosphere of freedom. Persons of genius are by definition more individual than other people, and are therefore less able to squeeze themselves safely into any of the small number of moulds that society provides, to save its members the trouble of forming their own character. If out of timidity they consent to be forced into one of these moulds, and to leave unexpanded all that part of themselves that can't expand under the pressure, society won't gain much from their genius. If they are of a strong character and break their fetters, they become a target for their society to point at with solemn warning as wild, erratic, and so on, like complaining against the Niagara River because it doesn't flow smoothly between its banks like a Dutch canal. When I insist so emphatically on the importance of genius, and the need to allow it to unfold freely both in thought and in practice, I'm well aware that no one will deny this position in theory, and also that hardly anyone cares in the slightest about it. People think genius a fine thing if it enables a man to write an exciting poem or paint a picture, but in the true sense of genius, that of originality in thought and action, most people secretly think they can do very well without it, though no one denies that it is admirable. This, alas, is too natural to be surprising. Originality is the one thing that unoriginal minds cannot feel the use of. They can't see what it can do for them. How could they? If they could see what it would do for them, it wouldn't be originality. The first thing originality must do for them is to open their eyes. And if they got their eyes fully open, they too would have a chance of being original. Meanwhile, recollecting that nothing was ever yet done that someone didn't do first, and that all good things that exist are the fruits of originality, let the unoriginal people be modest enough to believe that something is still left for originality to accomplish, and to assure themselves that the less conscious they are of their lack of originality, the greater is their need for it. In sober truth, whatever may be said or even done to honour real or supposed mental superiority, the general tendency of things throughout the world is to make mankind's dominant power mediocrity. In ancient history, in the Middle Ages, and to a lessening extent through the long transition from feudal times to the present, the individual was a power in himself, and if he had great talents or a high social position, he was a considerable power. These days, individuals are lost in the crowd. In politics, it almost goes without saying that public opinion now rules the world. The only real power is that of the masses, and of governments when they act out the tendencies and instincts of the masses. This is as true in the moral and social relations of private life as in public transactions. Those whose opinions count as public opinion are not the same sort of public in every country. In America, they are the whole white population. In England, chiefly the middle class. But they are always a mass, that is to say, collective, mediocrity. And a still greater novelty of the present age is this. The mass don't now take their opinions from dignitaries in church or state, from recognized leaders or from books. Their thinking is done for them by men much like themselves, addressing them or speaking in their name on the spur of the moment, through the newspapers. I'm not complaining about all this. I don't assert that anything better is generally compatible with the present low state of the human mind. But that doesn't stop the government of mediocrity from being mediocre government. No government by democracy or a numerous aristocracy, either in its political acts or in the opinions, qualities, and tone of mind that it encourages, ever did or could rise above mediocrity, except when the all-powerful many have let themselves be guided, which in their best times they always have done, by the influence of a more highly gifted and instructed one or few. all wise or noble things are, and must be, started by individuals, generally by some one individual. The honour and glory of the average man is his ability to follow that start, to respond internally to wise and noble things, and be led to them with his eyes open. I'm not endorsing the sort of hero-worship that applauds the strong man of genius for forcibly taking over the government of the world and making it do his bidding in spite of itself. All he is entitled to is freedom to point the way. The power of compelling others to follow it is not only inconsistent with the freedom and development of everyone else, but is also corrupting to the strong man himself. However, at a time when the opinions of masses of merely average men are becoming the dominant power, what seems to be needed as a counterweight and corrective to that tendency is more and more conspicuous individuality on the part of those whose intellects are well above average. It is especially in these circumstances that exceptional individuals, instead of being deterred, should be encouraged to act differently from the mass. At other times, there was no advantage in their doing so, unless they acted not only differently, but better. In the present age, the mere example of nonconformity, the mere refusal to bend the knee to custom, is itself a service, even if the way of life it leads to is not better than that of the mass, but only different from it. Precisely because the tyranny of public opinion makes eccentricity a fault, it is desirable, in order to break through that tyranny, that people should be eccentric. Eccentricity has always been plentiful when strength of character has been plentiful, and the amount of eccentricity in a society has generally been proportional to the amount of genius, mental vigour, and moral courage contained in the society. That so few now dare to be eccentric marks the chief danger of the time. I have said that it is important to give the freest possible scope to uncustomary things, so that in due course some of these may turn out to be fit for conversion into customs. But independence of action and disregard of custom don't deserve encouragement only because they may lead to better ways of action and customs more worthy of general adoption. And people of decided mental superiority are not the only ones with a just claim to carry on their lives in their own way. There is no reason why all human lives should be constructed on some one pattern, or some small number of them. If a person has even a moderate amount of common sense and experience, his own way of planning his life is the best, not because it is the best in itself, but because it is his own way. Human beings are not like sheep, and even sheep aren't indistinguishably alike. To get a coat or a pair of boots to fit him, a man needs either to have them made to his measure, or to have a warehouse full of coats or boots to choose from. Well, is it easier to fit him with a life than with a coat? Are human beings more like one another in their whole physical and spiritual makeup than in the shape of their feet? If people differed only in their tastes, that would be reason enough for not trying to fit them all into one mould. But different people also need different conditions for their spiritual development. They can't all exist healthily in the same moral atmosphere, any more than all plants can flourish in the same physical climate. The very things that help one person to develop his higher nature hinder another from doing so. A way of life that is a healthy excitement to one person, keeping all his faculties of action and enjoyment in their best order, is to another a distracting burden that suspends or crushes all his inner life. Human beings differ in their sources of pleasure, their susceptibilities to pain, and the effect on them of different physical and moral forces, so that unless their ways of life differ correspondingly, they won't get their fair share of happiness, and won't rise to the mental, moral, and aesthetic level they are capable of. Why then should tolerance, as far as the public attitude is concerned, extend only to tastes and ways of life that have to be accepted because so many people have them? Nowhere, except in some monastic institutions, is diversity of taste entirely unrecognized. A person may, without blame, either like or dislike rowing, or smoking, or music, or athletic exercises, or chess, or cards, or study, because those who like each of these things are too numerous to suppress, and so are those who dislike them. but the man, and still more the woman, who can be accused either of doing what nobody does, or of not doing what everybody does, is criticised as much as if he or she had committed some serious moral offence. You need to have a title, or some other badge of rank or of support from people of rank, if you're to be able to indulge somewhat in the luxury of doing as you like, without harm to your reputation. To indulge somewhat, I repeat, for someone who allows himself much of that indulgence, that permission to differ, runs the risk of something worse than verbal criticism. He is in danger of being committed as a lunatic, and of having his property seized and given to his relations. There is something contemptible and frightful in the sort of evidence on the basis of which, in recent years, a person can be judicially declared unfit to manage his affairs, and after his death his will can be set aside. All the minute details of his daily life are pried into, and if something is found that stupid witnesses see as even slightly out of the ordinary, it is laid before the jury as evidence of insanity. This move often meets with success, because the jurors are little, if at all, less vulgar and ignorant than the witnesses, while the judges, with that extraordinary ignorance of human nature and life that continually astonishes us in English lawyers, often help to mislead them. These trials speak volumes about what ordinary uneducated people feel and think with regard to human liberty. So far from respecting each individual's right to act, where others aren't concerned, in the way that seems good to his own judgment and inclinations, judges and juries can't even conceive that a sane person would want such freedom. In bygone days, when it was proposed to burn atheists, charitable people used to suggest putting them into a madhouse instead. It wouldn't be surprising to see this done now, with the doers applauding themselves for treating these unfortunates in such a humane and Christian manner, instead of persecuting them on behalf of religion, while also silently deriving satisfaction from the atheists getting what they deserve. One characteristic of the present direction of public opinion is especially apt to make it intolerant of any notable signs of individuality. The general average of mankind are moderate, middling, not only in intellect, but also in inclinations. They haven't any tastes or wishes strong enough to incline them to do anything unusual, so they don't understand those who have, and classify all such people with the wild and intemperate ones they are accustomed to look down on. Combine this general fact with the supposition that a strong movement has started towards the improvement of morals, and it is obvious what we have to expect. Well, these days, such a movement has started. Much has actually been brought about in the way of increased regularity of conduct and discouragement of excesses, and there is a widespread sense of philanthropy. For the moral and prudential improvement of our fellow creatures, there is no more inviting field than that. These tendencies of the times cause the public to be more disposed than ever before, almost, to try to make everyone conform to general rules of conduct. And the standard set by those rules, whether openly stated or silently understood, is to desire nothing strongly. Its ideal of character is to be without any notable character, to maim by compression, like a Chinese lady's bound foot, every part of human nature that stands out prominently and tends to make the person noticeably dissimilar in outline to commonplace humanity. As usually happens with ideals that exclude half of what is desirable, the present standard for approval produces only an inferior imitation of the other half. Instead of great energies, guided by vigorous reason, and strong feelings strongly controlled by a conscientious will, its result is weak feelings and energies. And just because they are weak, they can be made to conform to the rules without any strength of will or of reason. There is now scarcely any outlet for energy in this country except business. The energy expended in that may still be regarded as considerable. What little is left over from business is spent on some hobby. It may be useful and even philanthropic, but it is always some one thing, and generally a small thing. The greatness of England is now collective. We are all individually small, and seem capable of great things only through our habit of combining, and with this state of affairs our moral and religious philanthropists are perfectly contented. But it was men of a different type who made England what it has been, and men of a different type will be needed to prevent England's decline. The despotism of custom always blocks human advancement, because it is always hostile to the disposition to aim at something better than what is customary, a disposition that is called, depending on the circumstances, the spirit of liberty, or of progress, or of improvement. These three are not exactly the same, and I shall say a little about how they interrelate. The spirit of improvement isn't always a spirit of liberty, for it may aim at forcing improvements on an unwilling people, and when the spirit of liberty resists such attempts, it becomes, in that place and for a while, an ally of the opponents of improvement. But the only unfailing and permanent source of improvement is liberty, since through liberty there are as many possible independent centres of improvement as there are individuals. The progressive principle can be the love of liberty, or the love of improvement, and either way it opposes the dominance of custom, involving at least emancipation from that yoke. And what is of most interest in the history of mankind is this contest between improvement and custom. Most parts of the world have no history, properly so called, because in them the despotism of custom is complete. This is the case over the whole East. No one there thinks of resisting the argument from custom, except perhaps some tyrant intoxicated with power, and we see the result. Those nations must once have had originality. They didn't spring up out of the ground, populous, literate, and skilled in many of the arts of life. They made themselves like that, and at that time were the greatest and most powerful nations in the world. What are they now? The subjects or dependents of Europeans, tribes whose forefathers wandered in the forests when theirs had magnificent palaces and gorgeous temples, but over whom custom did not reign supreme, but shared its power with liberty and progress. It seems that a people may be progressive for a certain length of time, and then stop. When does it stop? When it ceases to possess individuality. If a similar change comes over the nations of Europe, it won't have exactly the same shape as in the East, because the despotism of custom with which the European nations are threatened is not precisely stationariness. It forbids singularity, but it doesn't rule out change, provided we all change together. We have discarded the fixed costumes of our forefathers. Everyone must still dress like other people, but the fashion may change once or twice a year. In this way, we take care that when there is change, it is for the sake of change, and not from any idea of beauty or convenience, for the same idea of beauty or convenience would not strike all the world at the same moment, and be thrown aside by everyone at another moment, and so to give any power to ideas of beauty or convenience would be a threat to uniformity. But we are progressive as well as changeable. We continually make new inventions in mechanical things, and keep them until they are superseded by something better. We are eager for improvement in politics, in education, even in morals, though our idea of moral improvement chiefly consists in persuading or forcing other people to be as good as we are. It isn't progress that we object to. On the contrary, we flatter ourselves that we are the most progressive people who ever lived. It is individuality that we oppose. We would think we had done wonders if we made ourselves all alike, forgetting that one person's unlikeness to another is generally what first leads one of them to notice the imperfection of his own type, and the superiority of the other, or the possibility of combining the advantages of both so as to produce something better than either. We have a warning example in China, a nation of much talent and even much wisdom in some respects. This is due to China's rare good fortune in having been provided at an early period with a particularly good set of customs that were partly the work of men whom even the most enlightened European must regard as sages and philosophers. The Chinese are remarkable, too, in the excellence of their apparatus for implanting, as far as possible, the best wisdom they have in every mind in the community, and seeing to it that those who have acquired the most of that wisdom occupy the positions of honour and power. Surely, you might think, the people who did this have discovered the secret of human progressiveness, and must have kept themselves steadily at the head of the movement of the world. On the contrary, they have become stationary, have remained so for thousands of years, and if they are ever to be further improved, it must be by foreigners. They have succeeded beyond all hope in doing what English philanthropists are so industriously working at, namely making a people all alike, all governing their thoughts and conduct by the same maxims and rules, and the Chinese people of today are the fruits of that success. The modern regime of public opinion is an unorganized version of what the Chinese educational and political systems have in an organized form. And unless individuality can successfully assert itself against this yoke, Europe, despite its noble antecedents and its professed Christianity, will tend to become another China. What has preserved Europe from this fate? What has made the European family of nations an improving rather than a stationary portion of mankind? It's not that they are more excellent than the Chinese. When excellence exists, it is an effect of improvement, not a cause. Rather, it is the remarkable diversity of character and culture among the Europeans. Individuals, classes, and nations have been extremely unlike one another. They have set out on a great variety of paths, each leading to something valuable. And although at every period those who travelled in different paths have been intolerant of one another, and each would have liked all the rest to be compelled to travel his road, their attempts to block each other's development have rarely had any permanent success, and each has eventually had to endure receiving the good the others have offered. Europe's progressive and many-sided development is due, in my judgment, wholly to this plurality of paths. But it is already starting to have less of this benefit. It is decidedly advancing towards the Chinese ideal of making all people alike. Monsieur de Tocqueville, in his last important work, remarks how much more the Frenchmen of the present day resemble one another than did those even of the last generation. The same remark might be made of Englishmen to a far greater degree. In a passage I have already quoted, Wilhelm von Humboldt points out two things that are required for human development, because they are required to make people unlike one another, namely, freedom and variety of situations. The second of these is diminishing day by day in this country. The circumstances that surround different classes and individuals and shape their characters are becoming more alike. Formerly, different ranks, neighbourhoods, trades, professions, lived in what might be called different worlds. At present, to a great degree, they inhabit the same world. Comparatively speaking, they now read the same things, listen to the same things, see the same things, go to the same places, have their hopes and fears directed to the same objects, have the same rights and liberties, and the same means of asserting them. The differences of position that remain are great, but they are nothing compared with the ones that have gone. And this process continues. All the political changes of the day promote it, since they all tend to raise the low and to lower the high. Every extension of education promotes it, because education brings people under common influences and gives them access to the general stock of facts and sentiments. Improvements in the means of communication promote it by bringing the inhabitants of distant places into personal contact, and keeping up a rapid flow of changes of residence between places. The increase in commerce and manufacture promotes it by spreading more widely the advantages of comfortable circumstances, and by opening all objects of ambition, even the highest, to general competition, so that the desire to rise is no longer a mark of a particular class, but of all classes. An even more powerful force in bringing about a general similarity among mankind is a way in which, in this and other free countries, public opinion completely dominates the state. There used to be various social heights that enabled persons dug in on them to disregard the opinion of the multitude, but they have gradually become levelled. The very idea of resisting the will of the public, when they are positively known to have a will, disappears more and more from the minds of practical politicians. So there stops being any social support for nonconformity, any substantive social power that is itself opposed to the dominance of numbers, and has a concern for taking under its protection opinions and tendencies at odds with those of the public. The combination of all these causes forms so great a mass of influences hostile to individuality that it is hard to see how it can stand its ground. It will do so with increasing difficulty unless the intelligent part of the public can be made to feel its value, to see that it is good that there should be differences, even if not for the better, indeed even if it sometimes seems to them to be for the worse. If the claims of individuality are ever to be asserted, the time is now, when the enforced assimilation is still far from complete. It is only in the earlier stages that any defence can be successfully mounted against the attack. The demand that all other people shall resemble ourselves grows by what it feeds on. If there is no resistance until life is reduced nearly to one uniform type, all variations from that type will come to be considered impious, immoral, even monstrous and contrary to nature. When mankind spend some time without seeing diversity, they quickly become unable even to conceive it. End of chapter 3.